Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Welcome, everyone, to EB5 Investment Voice and to what has been what I can only describe as a tumultuous week. What with the defeat of the Grassley-Leahy bill, the lapse of the Regional Center Program, the judge's decision in the Baring case, filing cases at $500,000 and all of the related implications. Phew. But there are a lot of questions, Rebecca.
Yes, Mona, there are plenty of questions out there. Let's see how much we can actually get through in the next 30 minutes of this podcast.
Right. We do have Aaron Grau, who's going to be joining us in a few minutes to discuss what actually did happen on the Senate floor and where we were able to progress from there. We do want to stress from the outset, as our listeners may be panicking, that the whole EB5 program has gone. The EB5 program has not disappeared. The EB5 program is part of law. What has lapsed is the regional center program.
Exactly, Mona. So the direct EB5 program is still in law. Any petitions within that program will still continue.
You know, Rebecca, there are so many misconceptions about the direct program. We're going to have tons of podcasts, I'm sure, just explaining some of the issues. I've seen people assume that it has to be at 1.8 million and not understand what a pooled investment is or any of these issues.
Yeah, and I've seen the same. And I think a lot of people in the last few days have asked and kind of shot down the direct program, not realizing this could actually help.
Well, at least it can keep going until we can get the regional center program back up.
Yes. Mona, we have Aaron Grau, who's just joined us from IOUSA. Welcome, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi, Aaron. Did you just come back from the Senate?
Not exactly. My heart and mind have been there, but I am at home. But no, I'm here.
So, Aaron, a lot of our listeners really want to understand what happened. Please, could you update us? And then, you know, where are we going?
Sure. I'm happy to. So, if you guys don't mind, I can give you sort of the full story here of how things went down.
Please.
As everybody knows, or perhaps are just becoming aware, Senator Grassley submitted to the Senate cloakroom a request to hotline S-831, the bill to reauthorize the Regional Center Program. A hotline is really a simple process the Senate uses to collect information from senators about who might oppose the bill. Because, of course, if you are seeking unanimous consent, one person opposing the bill will stop the bill's progress. So the hotline process is something, it's sort of a way to identify objectors. It's really the best way to describe it is an email blast that goes out from the cloakroom at the Senate to all of the senators saying, hey, we're looking for unanimous consent on this. Anybody have any problems? So 2 days ago, not yesterday, but the day before, the Republicans sent out a hotline from their cloakroom to all the members of the Republican caucus. Much later that day, the Democrats did the same thing. Senator Durbin, who is chairman of the Judiciary Committee, signed off on allowing the hotline of this bill to take place. And so we began to let the hotline notice marinate, if you will. And senators across the spectrum were taking a look at what the bill was and what it did and determining whether or not they had any objections to it. On the Republican side, we ultimately were able to identify three members who placed holds on the bill. In other words, indicated that they had an objection. One member was Senator Tuberville from Alabama, who maintained his hold throughout this process, but ultimately did not object to the bill. The other one, another one was Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who we understand had placed a hold on the bill simply because he wanted to study the measure. He wanted to understand what it was before he knew what he was consenting to. And the third one was Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, who had placed a hold on the bill. And there was mixed back and forth and back and forth whether Senator Graham had kept his hold on the bill or lifted his hold on the bill. But for our purposes, it was whether anybody, any of these men had holds on the bill. Incidentally, Rand Paul ended up lifting his hold, was neither here nor there, because the Republican cloakroom was reporting to us that none of the senators who had holds on the bill were going to go to the floor and object if the sponsors of the legislation went to the floor and asked for unanimous consent. So the fact that they wouldn't object there would ultimately mean that they would be waiving their hold and we would have no problems. On the Democratic side, it was a little bit more interesting, not as clear cut, because the Democratic cloakroom has a rule of not disclosing the names of people who put holds on the bill, which makes it a little difficult to understand how we might address their issues, them having objected in some way to the bill through the hotline process. However, we were able to identify a few of them simply because they actually called Senator Leahy's office to let them know. So one senator was Senator Ossoff from Georgia. He was interested in simply understanding more about the legislation. And I think once he had a good understanding of what it was, he lifted his hold. Another was Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who similarly ended up lifting his hold. And then there was a third mystery hold, one that we could not identify, and we didn't know who it could possibly be. However, as we came closer to yesterday afternoon at 12:30, which was when the Senate had scheduled to hear the unanimous consent request from the floor, all of the Democrat holds were lifted. In other words, the entire Democratic caucus offered no indication whatsoever that they opposed the bill at all.
Oh, wow. So our grassroots efforts did work.
Absolutely, they did. Absolutely, they did.
Fantastic.
They were invaluable. And so from Senator Schumer on down to the lowest ranking freshman Democrat senator there is, I'm not sure who that is, nobody opposed the bill. And from the Republican perspective, we understood that although there were holds, no one would be coming to the floor. However, we were scheduled to hear the unanimous consent request at 12:30 Eastern time. We actually saw Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy, and this is meaningful, Senator Cornyn from Texas. All three of these men went to the floor at 12:15 Eastern time to seek unanimous consent. Around 11:45 or so, we started hearing rumors and information that Senator Graham, in fact, was not only not going to lift his hold, but that he had decided to object. At that point, despite immeasurable best efforts, given the 20 minutes or so we had, Senator Graham did go to the floor, as everybody heard or saw on television. And when the unanimous consent request was offered, he simply said, "I object," and left the Senate floor. And that sealed the fate of S-831. Without that last senator agreeing to unanimity, the bill failed. Well, I take that back. The bill did not fail. Passing it by unanimous consent failed. The bill is still very much alive. And so that's where we stand. That was the whole TikTok, if you will, of the proceedings as to how they went down. And I'm happy to say that despite that setback, stakeholders are already back at the table and in conversations, hoping to find a solution to reauthorizing the program. So we'll see what happens.
Is there any indication, Aaron, why Senator Graham did that? There's an old Wall Street Journal going back to January of 2020, which talks about the bill that was brought in by Senator Rounds in November of 2019. And Senator Graham was a sponsor of that bill. So why would he object at this stage?
There's speculation about why he did this. But I think I might be stepping into hot water if I aired speculative stories on a podcast. The truth of the matter is that regardless of what rumors are out there with regards to who spoke to who about what to convince the senator to do this, I don't know the truth. It'll be up to others to ferret that out, and I'm sure they will over time. I think the one fact that we have in front of us that's indisputable is that it was Senator Graham who objected to the bill, and it will be Senator Graham who will need to explain himself at some point and hopefully help address whatever concerns prompted him to put the hold on the bill to help us finally get this program up and running long term.
Okay, so the question is, could we have another debate like this, or is that it? And if not, we are looking at the lapse of the Regional Center Program. What's the solution?
Well, we can have another debate like this, and we will have another debate like this. When I say debate like this, however, I think what we're really talking about is the substance of the issues, not the politics or the procedures of the issues. The Senate has adjourned, so there will be no other efforts to pass the bill on the Senate side. The House has not adjourned, and the House may still take up this issue, interestingly. They may even pass a bill. It would be more of a symbolic gesture than anything else, I think, simply because the Senate will not address this until well after the July 4th recess. And of course, that includes June 30th. So the program will expire. We anticipate that USCIS will be as generous as it has been in the past with lapses in the program with regards to how its guidance will suggest handling applications and visa applications. That remains to be seen. But this administration, as we know, is very conscious, very predisposed to supporting immigrants and their families. I anticipate there being stress. We're all feeling that right now, but I don't anticipate it lasting for long. I hope that that's not the case.
Well, thank you, Aaron. And thank you very much. And we look forward to hearing from you again in the future when you have some more news that you can share with us and our listeners.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful day and a good weekend. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you. Same to you. Well, I'm glad that Aaron was there, Rebecca, because I wouldn't have remembered all of the names.
It was good to have him clarify everyone. And it was good to hear who was for the bill and what happened during the hotline process.
Right. What happens now to anybody who's waiting or pending or petitions that are pending? Rebecca, there's a huge backlog for the 485s as well, right?
Yes. Yes. At this time, because unfortunately with COVID, from the consular processing and from adjustment of status, if you're in the United States, there is a huge backlog. So I think the concern here is with investors who have pending not just I-526 petitions, but also pending I-45 petitions, or if you have a DS-260 pending at the consulate, what happens?
So last time there was a lapse in the program, a short lapse back in 2018, USCIS did come up with some guidance. And I think that guidance basically stated that they were going to hold all of these cases in abeyance until a time that the Regional Center Program was reinstated.
Yes, that's exactly what they did. So they did accept the I-526 petitions and I-45 at the time the program was lapsing. They did do that, but then they just held on to it.
Yeah. And if you remember, 2019 was a terrible year for EB-5 adjudications. There was no COVID or any other excuse. Actually, if you remember, we received a number of approvals for direct projects and pooled direct projects, but no regional centers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why from the beginning, don't underestimate the direct pool project. The program is still there and will continue going while the regional center program has lapsed. But also for listeners out there, not just investors, but even regional centers who are out there, the I-924, if you're trying to have a new a regional center designation, those applications will stop as well. But they did issue and said that if we have the I-924As, which you have to renew the regional center, those applications were still being accepted. So I thought that was important for our listeners to hear.
Right.
And for those who have I-829 petitions, because you already have the conditional green card and you're already a resident of the United States, your I-829 petitions will continue to get adjudicated.
Right. So it doesn't affect anybody other than those who haven't yet had their petition adjudicated, new petitions, and people waiting for the green cards.
Exactly.
Which is quite a lot of people.
Yeah, yes, yes. And unfortunately, with China and those other countries in a backlog, I don't know how much longer they'll have to wait now.
Right, Rebecca. We still have a lot to get through. Now, the Baring case, the judge in the Baring case came down for the plaintiff, which meant that the regulations that were imposed or brought into law on November 21st, 2019, are now no longer actual law. But it does not mean to say that any of the petitions that were filed between November 21st, 2019 to what was the date that she came in, Rebecca? 21st?
Yeah, 22nd, June 22nd.
June 22nd.
The decision came out of this year.
June 22nd of this year. Those are still good law. But what does it mean moving forward, Rebecca?
Oh, gosh. Well, right now, anyone can file at the 500,000 level.
Yeah,
until we get an appeal or stay, then we would, you know, it all depends on whether or not we go back or the dates are retroactive back to November 21st, 2019.
Right. So people are asking, what does that mean? So just to explain, the government will be appealing, and the government have already stated that they are reaffirming the regulations which went in 2019. What we don't know is what will happen is whether this particular period will be an actual lapse or whether or not the regulations, the new regulations will be retroactive back to the 2019 date, which would mean that anyone who's filed under the 500 level would be required to pay another 400,000 to make it 900,000.
Yeah, so we're getting all these questions, Mona, from investors, potential investors. Is it really safe to file at the 500,000 level?
Well, I think it is at this point because that is what the law is today. And you can certainly file because that is what the current situation, the current law is. But there is a possibility that you would have to come up with an additional amount of capital in the future. But there is nothing wrong with filing at this particular point.
I agree. But I think for investors, I would caution to take a look at the projects you're investing in. Make sure there's some safeguard or protection for you in case the 500,000 is no longer there. What are the outcomes or what can the project do to either, will they be able to repay you if you can't afford the 900,000, or will they be giving you the opportunity to come back and add in the extra 400,000? So just investors should be careful of where they're investing in.
Well, the project documents are very important, and mm-hmm. there's been lots of discussions with ourselves, with other lawyers in this area as to what the project documents should look like. I think the general consensus is that the project documents should perhaps state 900,000 and that you're allowed 500,000 at this point. But, you know, it's all open to interpretation, and we have yet to see what kind of guidance or what USCIS is going to come back with.
The other issue, Mona, is because now with the regional center program lapsing, a lot of investors are trying to get in last minute. And we've had this situation back in November of 2019, where investors, again, were just trying to get their applications in. But be very careful, because if you file what's called a skeletal filing, where you're producing very little documents just to get your application in, there could be complications in the end, or implications, I should say. And USCIS have come back and said they would deny the petition outright without even giving an RFE or a NOID, which was a request for evidence or notice of intention to deny, to respond back.
That's right. The other question that people are asking is how long the window is open at the 500,000. So it could take a couple of weeks for the government to file an appeal, and we don't know whether or not there would be an immediate injunction. So you might have a window open. However, the regional center program window closes on Tuesday.
Okay.
But a direct program doesn't. So if somebody wants to try and file under the direct program until such a time that the government do appeal, or that we do know that the regulations are not being retroactive, I think it's worth a chance.
Yeah, I think going the direct route would be the safest bet.
I agree. And just like last time, it was the direct route, which all the petitions in the direct route were adjudicated so much faster than the regional center ones.
Yeah, it's almost a fast track through. yeah. So.
Yes, yes. Somebody was asking whether or not Mayorkas is going to be very upset about this, and can he ratify the regs in between, waiting for the adjudication? I think he can.
I think so. He tried to do that at the time the judge was contemplating the decision, but that did not get through.
Yeah.
So Mona, can you just sum up what you mean by the notice of appeal?
Right. So the judge has already given her decision. So USCIS has to file a notice of appeal with the U.S. Court of Appeals and seek a stay of a lower district court's decision to vacate the rule, because, you know, it was the first courts, the lower district court, which gave the decision. The Court of Appeals then grants a stay and the regulations at 900 go in effect again. But another situation which could happen is that the Court of Appeals does not grant the stay and the regulations are still vacated. What's interesting really that we need to look at is that, you know, will the government actually just look to reaffirm regulations on a new date moving forward? I feel that with the regional center program actually lapsing, there isn't the same pressure on the government. And I don't think that they're going to be too worried about a huge mass of petitions coming in, as we really only have two more days left.
Yeah. Well, I think it's twofold, right? We have the regulations with USCIS, and then we have Congress coming in with the actual law and if a bill would come through.
Don't forget also that USCIS has to publish the new notice in the Federal Register for the new regulations to come in. And that, I believe, is 30 days.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different scenarios that can play out in the next few weeks.
Right, right. Yeah. Again, giving an opportunity, a window of opportunity to anybody who wants to file a direct case.
Yeah. And of course, with the regional center lapsing, it's not to say that it's gone forever, right, Mona?
Well, that's what Aaron was talking about. We are seeing the bill is still there. Whether or not we see the bill reemerge in the short term, we have to wait and see. But we know that a program like the regional center program, which brings in more than $10 billion worth of money, is not a program that is just going to be allowed to just, you know, disappear.
Exactly. So we know for sure, we've seen it over time again, 32 times this program has been extended. I'm sure we'll see the 33rd.
And as Aaron said, this particular government does care about the investors. So I don't think we're going to see harm to the investors. There may be a delay, and there's likely to be a delay, but I don't see any real harm.
I agree.
So we will try to keep you guys updated with whatever happens. We will try to come up with breaking news. So please stay tuned to both this podcast and our blog. And thank you for listening to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.